The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. How often do you say no? And I don't know if it's a conspiracy theory. I don't know if it's anything connected to the fact that my phone knows absolutely everything about my life and that it knows that Nick Haralambos, who is a business coach and who has been a regular on The Money Show for many years, is rejoining us this evening to reflect on a letter that he wrote to him, his 20-year-old self. And he is going to be sharing that with us. But one of the points he says, learn to say no. And you don't have to justify why you say no. And suddenly I see Stephen Bartlett talking about saying no. And lots of people on my LinkedIn feed are saying, you don't have to say no. You don't have to say yes all the time. Learn to say no. Normalize saying no without needing to explain yourself. If somebody's offended by your boundaries, that's their problem. What do you make of that? There's a huge amount of pressure on us to say yes to everything. And if you spread yourself too thin, every bit of what you try to achieve is going to be diluted. And so I wonder whether the power of no is something that we need to be looking at a bit more closely. We'll be looking at the gas industry and the impact it's having on the people who use most of it. We'll reflect on the life of Dr. Sam Motsuanyane this evening. He's died at the age of 97 and he's left an astonishing legacy, a massive contribution, particularly to black business in the apartheid era, and set up some extraordinary structures and was instrumental in the development, for example, of African Bank, and people online today referring to it as the old African Bank. Very clearly a difference, and we'll reflect on that tonight as well. We'll look at Nigeria. It gets two big focuses tonight, both in our Africa Business Report and in a special feature where we look at the impact of the Nigerian business, of course, on what is happening with the MTN in Nigeria. So big pressure being brought to bear there. And then also 7:30, we've got Warren Ingram, personal finance, here on The Money Show. The Money Show, of course, is brought to you by those nice people at APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
We've had day zero on water in Cape Town, on electricity and then water in Gauteng, and now on gas. Day zero may very well be looming. Industrial gas users really worried with about a draft gas master plan. It's been published by the Department for Mineral Resources and Energy, and it seems to be lacking. Yaku Himan has spoken to us on this issue before, the chief executive of the Industrial Gas Users Association of Southern Africa. What is wrong with the master plan here, Yaku?
Good evening, Bruce. We've been engaging with government on the development of the master plan for some time, and we've had some fruitful engagements, and we've long held the view that the master plan needs to address, first and foremost, the critical issues around, as you put it, the day zero for gas. Now, the master plan does not. You know, the published master plan does not do that, which renders the rest of the gas master plan basically of academical importance.
Okay, so it's not a gas master plan that is not a plan that is implementable or useful, therefore not a plan at all. You say you've been consulting. How closely has your contribution been included within the master plan, if at all?
The master plan references the short-term situation and the shortfall in gas supply, basically from the perspective of Richards Bay and the developments that is aligned with all the solutions that the master plan put forward around the car power ships again. And but that only addresses 15% of the issue. The other 85%, it seemingly refers to gas imports or regional gas imports, which we don't understand. And we're not sure where that gas is going to come from to solve the industrial issues inland.
Okay, it comes at the moment, most of it, as far as I know, from Mozambique, and that's the core of the problem, isn't it?
That's correct, Bruce. I mean, we're currently dependent on the gas, the natural gas flow which Sasol provides or produces from Pande Temane, which is in the southern parts of Mozambique. And that resource has now reached the end of its life. Hence, Sasol's position and announcement at the moment that it will have to cease gas supply from June 2026, which is literally 24 months away.
And again, 24 months is an awfully long time. It's a whole 2 years ago. Way, Jakob. But what we've learned, I think, in recent years is the moment you start thinking that 2 years is an awfully long time, you start running out of time to make an alternative arrangement. And you probably are getting to the very end of that period where you can sensibly and sustainably come up with an alternative before the middle of 2026.
So I think the big question is to what extent government, the South African government, can support industry. And I think in the coming weeks, industry will have to make a decision to what extent it simply has to row its own boat. And there are options and developments that we are looking at, but it certainly doesn't take the risk away of a day zero scenario from June 2026. I mean, even if we start today, the soonest we can get alternative gas into the country is around the second half of 2027, which clearly leaves us with a gap, you know, of 12 to 18 months. So industry is certainly reviewing all its options and will consider its decisions in terms of, let's put it this way, rowing its own boat, you know, in the absence of any government support.
It's a real concern, of course. I mean, these things, and the reason you're here, of course, is to ramp up the pressure on the Department of Mineral Resources to say, please up your game. Do you hold much hope that is one possible, two likely?
We've had engagements with the government. I mean, the DTIC, I think in our previous conversation, we referenced the DTIC process, which coordinates the involvement of various government departments and machinery into a single conversation around these challenges and what need to be done. We started off late last year on a good footing, but it is sort of fizzled away almost, you know, and we're simply not sure what we can expect from the government at this point in time.
That's a real concern. Jaco, thank you very much indeed. Jaco Himan is the chief executive of the Industrial Gas Users Association. We've had lots of day zeros. None of them have come to fruition in true disaster form. But my goodness me, we do like to tap dart on the edge of self-destruction sometimes. Jaco Himan, thank you very, very much indeed. I don't know if you've noticed, but a lot of people wearing retro Adidas sneakers. And I found a piece today that Adidas's Samba and Gazelle sneakers, which look like they come from, I don't know, let's be kind, 80s, certainly retro. And the German sportswear company that owns Adidas, of course, says that the sales of those retro style shoes are very strong and growing. It helped it increase its first quarter profits at the company. It's still trying to find its footing, of course. It's had all sorts of collaborations and all kinds of clever ideas. It turns out that if you go back to the past and you then bring out your hits from the olden days, you may just find some winners hidden in there somewhere. There's a reason why those shoes were popular and hip in that time. I wonder whether or not more brands could learn from that.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, tribute today for the businessman Sam Motsuenyane, who's died at the age of 97. He's made a huge contribution to South Africa's business, political and social life. But it was his contribution to black business in apartheid South Africa, and amongst his enduring achievements, the co-founding of NAFCOC, the National African Federated Chamber of Commerce. And he, of course, he was critical in the establishment of African Bank. Let's go to Thabo Dlothi first. Thabo is the chairman of African Bank. And it's 30 years into our democracy, Thabo. It's hard to think, to contextualize the enormity of the achievements of people like Sam Motsuenyane during apartheid to do what they did in the face of massive state opposition to anything black people tried to do to uplift themselves.
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, it is very difficult to imagine what Dr. Sam Motsuenyane and his colleagues were foreseeing at a very difficult time in South Africa. They conceived the bank in 1964. You can only imagine what was happening in 1964. Could only launch the bank actually in 1975, given the challenges that were in front of them. But tribute to them that they did actually launch a bank in 1975. despite everything else going on in the country and the challenge they're facing, as you were saying.
What do you mind? I mean, yes, you're the chairman of African Bank now. African Bank is a fundamentally different business to what it was under Leon Kokkinos before it went into curatorship, and a fundamentally different bank to that was created by Sam Motsuenyane and his colleagues in the 1970s. But what is the enduring legacy, as you see it, of Sam Motsuenyane to South Africa's current business environment?
Dr. Motsuenyane, one of the things he used to really stress hard in dealing with us was that African Bank was designed and was planned, was envisaged to support small businessmen. And his belief was that that really is the cork that drives the economy. If the black business is not supported to meaningfully participate in the broader sector, we will really not be able to address the fundamental issues we are dealing with in the country. So we have taken that challenge on board that African Bank can truly succeed in achieving the vision of its founders if it truly addresses that issue. Hence, the build of a business bank and really trying to focus and supporting the black business person that is starting out there.
Thabo Dlothi, thank you very much indeed, the chairman of African Bank, and the mentorship also, of course, of Dr. Sam Motsuenyane as well, to a new generation of black business leaders in South Africa, absolutely instrumental too. Bongi Konene is with the Banking Association of South Africa. And Bongi, again, your thoughts on the legacy of Sam Motsuenyane and what he and his co-founders of both NAFCOC and African Bank have left us in the 21st century?
Well, first, condolences to the family and to the African Bank family. He is a man that will be remembered for being a visionary. To start a bank in 1974-75, have your first branch in Garankuwa, and move the bank to all corners of South Africa. It shows that he had a vision of the ability of an entrepreneur to fund their businesses and grow it step by step. We will miss that from him.
Bongi, thank you. The Banking Association Chief Executive, Bongi Konene, this evening. To the Chief Executive of Business Unity South Africa, Kaz Kuvadia. He was cut from a different cloth, I think, Kaz Kuvadia, at a time where black people were massively restrained, restricted, and forbidden from doing many of the activities that he and his colleagues embarked upon. I wonder what lessons we draw from the likes of Sam Motsuenyane in this decade and beyond that gives us, I don't know, some wisdom on actually creating businesses in an environment that I would argue, and people might fight with me, is not nearly as restrictive and as difficult as it was back then.
Yeah, so I think the lessons are that, you know, irrespective of the environment in which you work, if you persevere, you work hard, you work honorably and ethically, you can build a business. You can be innovative. You can trailblaze, and you can do that if you understand that there's no quick roads to successful business. It's hard work, it's thinking on your feet, it's being flexible to actually address the environment in which you're working, and then being flexible enough to change tack as you need to change tack. And so those were, I mean, Dr. Motsuenyane and his ilk were real trailblazers. They learned on their feet. They innovated as they went along, as the conditions changed, as the conditions pertained at that time. So I think the lesson for us is there's no quick fixes to anything. Businesses don't just grow quickly. You've got to work at it. You've got to understand the environment. You've got to talk to the environment, you've got to respond to the environment, and you've got to work hard, and you've got to work honorably.
Work hard and work honourably. Thank you, Cass Kuvaidia, this evening. Just take a couple of views this evening, and you may have had views. Sam Motsanyani had an impact in your life, a positive impact in your life. Certainly, we've seen recently the death of Raymond Ackerman also, and his challenges were very different, of course, to those of Sam Motsanyani's. He wasn't facing a hostile state. But Sam Motsanyani and a generation of business leaders from the 1960s and 1970s, creating a framework that many people could still relate to and continue to mentor and continue to support young business people. If your business has grown as a result of the work of Sam Motsanyani, you'd be curious about it. Give us a shot. 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To the founder of Herenia Capital Advisors we go, Pietri Riedlinghuis. After a week of fairly solid gains, driven, I think, by some pro-Anglo BHP deal sentiment, some slowdown news out of the United States, I think that today's pullback was probably due.
Yeah, well, it comes to a bit of a screeching halt today, doesn't it?
We had a screaming halt and a bit of a reverse. That's what it did.
Last week as well. I mean, if you look from around the 22nd of April all the way through to yesterday, really, market was quite strong, particularly in the US. And as you say, I think we had a bit of a relief bounce. In general, we here at Herenia are in bear mode at the moment. So we had a little bit of a relief bounce, and we saw a couple of data points come out today, which I think was part of the reason why in the last couple of hours of the trading session, the market basically just had a bit of a meltdown. And we see the currency, lost about 1% of ground as well in the sort of in the last few hours of trade today. I think that was a bit, on the back of data that we saw from the U.S., particularly data being, better than expected employment data and then worse than expected GDP data coming from Canada. So that shows more inflation on the horizon, right? Which means higher interest rates for longer. We've all been holding our breath, waiting for 2 to 3, maybe even 4 interest rate cuts this year. And the prospects are dwindling by the day here, right? So higher interest rates, unfortunately, has just pounded commodities, pounded the currencies, the dollar index, indices, everything just sort of got smashed on the back of that employment data. Because we know what this means. Good employment numbers means higher inflation.
And that's the trouble, isn't it? It's these constant signals that guys like you are looking out for. Constantly, there's a slight improvement there, a slight deterioration there. Add the two together, subtract the power of pi, and then come up with a supposition. And this is precisely why. I mean, I don't mean to give away your trade secrets here, Petri, but it's the environment which you describe as you in bear mode, and that is a negative mindset. You're looking at markets, you say they rallied in anticipation of cuts which are not yet coming and may not come at all this year, and therefore surely there's got to be some sort of correction.
Yeah, basically, in a nutshell, that's exactly it. And I think also to add to that, I think we look at some of the valuations in the tech sector, and I know it's been very fashionable and very the right thing to do to be long of tech stocks, right? To be invested in the Apples and the Intels and the Nvidias and all those things. But if you look at them from through a rational, perspective, some of these stocks are overvalued like crazy. If you look at Sasol, and I know Sasol is very popular to be bearish on Sasol at the moment, but it's trading at a price to earnings ratio of like under 3, right? Historically, this thing would trade between 6 and 10 on a PE ratio. And if you expect earnings, we expect earnings to be somewhere between 50 Rand and 65 Rand coming up, that puts it at 360, but in the range of almost, 300 to 360 Rand a share. So it's super undervalued, but everybody's piled into the tech stocks and avoided anything that's not ESG and, not environmentally friendly or whatever. And I think that this has created a bit of a value gap for, good old-fashioned commodity stocks, oil stocks, energy stocks, and has overvalued a lot of these tech things. And I think that is really where our bearish narrative comes from. It's like, how much longer can the handful of few tech companies that push the indexes, the U.S. indices in particular, all the way up the page, how long can they stay up there if interest rates are not going to come down, the economy is going to come under pressure, their earnings are going to come under pressure, and people are going to want to then rotate into their investments into value, right? So get out of the popular things and get into the unpopular things is kind of our viewpoint at this stage.
It's such an important point to make, and it's a, you know, people feel very uncomfortable with it because while the going is good, it is very, very good, and when it goes bad, it goes rotten horribly fast. But the courage of beginning to lighten what has done so well for you and going into something that has been doing terribly for everybody else is more than a leap of faith, isn't it? This is a leap of mathematics, science, and then faith, because you've got to hope that there are more people who feel like you than don't.
Earlier, where it's all a bit of voodoo and hocus pocus. It's more faith than mathematics and science. I promise you that. I think that the truth is, anybody who tells you that they know exactly what's going to happen next is, they don't, right? At the end of the day, we all take essentially views on what we think is most probable to happen. If we get it right, we make some money.
And what Pietri Redinghuis, the founder at Herenia Capital Advisors, thank you very much, Pietri Redinghuis. His big bet is that sanity prevails, that investors realize that the hot air and hocus pocus of American tech begins to wear a little bit thin. They don't die, they don't go bankrupt, they don't fall over, but certainly the valuations are incredibly demanding, which means that you're unlikely to see big returns from the current levels in the next little while. His bet is that you'll see it from the likes of Sasol. It's unloved, unliked, untouched by many. And if, old school investment principles remain intact, which they have for hundreds of years, your money is probably better off there. It's a big bet. Thank you to Pietri Redinghuis for taking it.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We're going to talk about MTN and Nigeria and the constant worries around Nigeria for investors for companies in, of course, many parts of the African continent. But Nigeria's turning into a very expensive place to do business. We'll pick up on that with Duncan McLeod in just a moment. And it's quite interesting to see how much more creative the private healthcare sector is getting now that it is feeling the heat as a result of a deeply flawed bill, but it's nevertheless a bill that sits on the president's desk that needs to be signed into law in terms of NHI. Now, for whatever reason, the president is just holding off on signing on that bill, yet the private healthcare sector is sitting there going, so what if he does? What if he does? What if he does? What happens to the future? Is this Armageddon? What are we going to be doing next? So we're watching this space very, very, very closely. And naturally, the healthcare sector is concerned. So that is all in the next half hour. Warren Ingram at 7:30, and then Nick Haralambos joins us just after Eyewitness News at 7:00, a different take on our weekly Signals feature.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
A millstone for MTN is Nigeria. The cell phone operator, though, continuing to find innovative ways to think long-term about its business in that country, despite the fact that it's reporting another loss and there's little sign as to how or when it may start contributing positively to the rest of the business. Duncan McLeod, the editor at Tech Central. I don't know where to start on this one, frankly, Duncan. It is a business that seemed like a good idea, good demographics, wealthy population, lots of people need to use cell phones. MTN went in probably 20 years ago now and said, we want to dominate this place. And for many of those 20 years, it's proven to be an absolute drag.
It has, Bruce. Good evening. I was chatting to Ralph Mopita, the group CEO. It must have been towards the middle of last year, and I was asking him about the woes in Nigeria, which had already started then with the rapid decline in the value of the Naira, which was impacting them. And he felt that the new administration there, the new president there, was doing stuff that was going to cause them short-term pain. But his view was that once that pain is over, it's going to restructure and reset the Nigerian economy on a better platform. I haven't spoken to him about it since then, but he was quite positive at the time about the reforms that were happening in the market, such as the end of the fuel subsidy, which has meant that they're paying a lot more for diesel to keep their base stations in that country running. And he was quite optimistic that once all of these reforms are out of the way, which are causing an enormous amount of short-term pain in the Nigerian economy, inflation is running very hot. I think it's sitting at about 35%. That Nigeria will have reset itself and it'll be on a better platform for growth. So I presume that's still how he feels about the Nigerian market. But certainly in the short term, they are feeling a considerable amount of pain. They're reporting a forex loss in the first 3 months of the 2024 financial year of 9 billion rand. So it's a lot of pain that they're taking in the short term.
It is, and I wonder just how other companies are managing in Nigeria, other telecommunications companies, other sort of internet businesses in Nigeria. Does everybody sort of, I'm assuming everyone's in the same boat and the same issues afflict absolutely everybody?
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, the operators there are jointly lobbying the communications regulator in Nigeria where prices are not, they can't adjust prices as easily as they can, for example, in the South African market. Here, it's pretty much a rubber stamp exercise, and the regulators pretty much allows price increases to help them manage their costs. But in Nigeria, they can't just push up prices, so they've got to have negotiations with the regulator, which I think is making things more difficult in an environment where inflation is running very high. So there is that aspect to it as well, but they are lobbying the regulator for those price adjustments. But it's certainly a very tough environment. It's not just MTN that's feeling it. I think it's all businesses in Nigeria, and consumers are also being squeezed. And I think we're seeing in the numbers here that it's not only the Nigerian market. In fact, all the markets they operate in across Africa, consumers are under pressure. But in Nigeria, the pain is particularly acute. One assumes that this Naira devaluation is going to have to end at some point. The Reserve Bank, or the equivalent of the Reserve Bank in Nigeria, is making moves to support the currency, but there may be more downside before things turn.
Is there a risk that at some point MTN Group is going to have to pour extra capital into Nigeria?
I'm not qualified to answer that question, Bruce. It's I guess it is possible, but I haven't delved into the numbers in that sort of detail to be able to answer that confidently.
It's a question for Ralph Mopita. We will talk to him. Thank you, Duncan McLeod, very, very much indeed, the founder and editor at Tech Central, with a very good answer to a very tough question. Ralph Mopita saying that, you know, the strategy is focused on addressing the current negative capital position. Part of the initiative, it is engaging with authorities to negotiate industry-wide tariff increases to help manage the effects of a difficult operating environment. But if they don't get those tariff increases, are they then going to have to ask our own Reserve Bank, hello, please can we pop some extra capital into Nigeria? And at that point, what decisions are made? I wonder. So yes, Duncan McLeod, thank you very much. At the cutting edge of everything to do with telecommunications, not only in South Africa, but across the continent. In a moment, Craig Cormery. Craig is the chair of the Health Funders Association. This is an association of everybody in the private sector who is in the healthcare industry. And we're waiting. It's the 30th of April. The president has not yet signed the National Health Insurance Bill into law. And I wonder why. I'm not too sure that we've got an insight into it. And with all the clutter and the noise and the uncertainty of elections looming, whether or not we're going to get that bill signed into law by the 29th of May. And, you know, whatever happens after that, of course, is a different story. But yes, there is a piece of legislation that is potentially damaging to South Africa's not only private, but certainly public healthcare sector and to everybody's healthcare in South Africa. We'll talk to Craig Cormery, the chairperson of the Health Funders Association, in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
What's interesting is the increasing retail rollout of De Beers. De Beers, we know, is a subsidiary of Anglo American, probably for not much longer, particularly if BHP Group gets its way. It will then need to find new investors or relist on the stock market somewhere. But it's interesting to see Al Cook, who is the chief executive of De Beers Group in China last week, visiting what they're calling their flagship De Beers Jewelers Boutiques in the region and connecting with industry players. Al Cook saying that China's been the fastest growing market for diamond jewelry demand in recent decades. And while the current macroeconomic environment has been challenging, both natural diamonds and China's economic development are expected to maintain their long-term resilience. And that's kind of important. You've got to be able to make a call on these things. And the China is going to be home to more than half of the De Beers stores. And it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, is De Beers a diamond miner into the future or a diamond retailer into the future? Or is it simply going to focus on continuing to be both? If you've ever been into a De Beers flagship store, it's very sparkly, very nicely laid out, an exceptional space. But does the success of the retail stores depend on the success of the mines and the mining operations? Or could they just buy those in at some point in the future? I wonder. Anyway, Al Cook, the chief executive of De Beers in China. 20 stores so far with a growth plan in that market, despite the fact that the economy looks tough. Often when markets and economies look tough, it's a good time to invest.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
But something is holding back shares in South Africa's healthcare sector, and I suspect it's got something to do with National Health Insurance, the NHI. And there's nothing like a burning platform to spark creativity. And the NHI bill sitting on the president's desk could wreak havoc, not only with the health system, the public health system, but the private healthcare system, and could lead to devastating economic consequences if it is implemented in the way the law proposes. It could have a very serious budget impact. Widening, therefore, private healthcare sector quicker may very well be more effective than actually implementing NHI. At least that is what Craig Comrie, the chair of the Health Funders Association, wants us to think. Please explain this to me, Craig. A private healthcare sector on the ropes, feeling the pressure, the burning pressure of the potential of the president simply adding his signature to a piece of paper and fundamentally changing the game of healthcare in South Africa. Not for good, but for worse, I would suspect. What is the industry thinking now in terms of better quality proposals?
Yeah, I think at the start, thanks, Bruce, and good to be with you. But at the start, there's been a huge amount of collaboration in terms of standing up to this NHI bill. It hasn't yet been signed in, and so the assurance to the whole community is that it'll take many years to implement, and we've seen some of these healthcare plans, such as NHI plans, being implemented over decades, and so that assurance goes out to the private sector at the moment. However, it does have an immediate impact, especially when it comes to the very scarce healthcare resources, and I speak specifically about the doctors and specialists, who will take 7 years to get qualified. And then, as we've seen globally, there are very attractive global markets that want them in their territories to supplement the gaps that have arisen since COVID in terms of healthcare providers. And so the issue for us as the Funders Association, and we represent almost 20 medical schemes, is that if you take more people and place them in the private sector and allow for the medical scheme rebates or subsidies to take place, as designed many years ago, this takes the burden off the rest of the healthcare fiscus and budget and allows the rest of the population who requires and those that are in need to access those benefits in the public sector. And so that step of reformation was suggested many years ago in the late 2000s under a social health insurance scenario that hasn't yet come to fruition and is being effectively replaced by what is seen as the NHI bill today.
One of the biggest allergies, of course, in a public sector that is not performing, let's be kind, optimally. I beg your pardon, I'm even getting My voice is even going as I talk about health.
Have you gone for your flu jab, Bruce?
Oh, of course. Very diligent on that particular front.
Good.
This is
well done.
This is a frog. Now, one of the big issues, of course, is that, and I don't know if it's this petty, but that lots of aspects of the public sector do look bad when juxtaposed against the success of the private sector. Is that part of the problem?
In a fair lens, yes, there's lots of funding issues in the public sector, but as well as leadership issues. So the efficiency of providing services in the public sector is under severe pressure. In the private sector, where we also require reforms, it seemed to be very expensive in terms of a South African context, but worldwide, in comparison to some of the worldwide systems, the private sector in South Africa is actually quite reasonably priced. So you have both of these systems working alongside each other, and the reforms have to try and address and bring the two systems closer together so that we provide better healthcare to all those that are in South Africa. Now, I guess there's lots of distrust from both sides, and much of that is manifest in how the bill is written and throughout the consultation processes that have taken place, the fact that the bill has hardly changed since it was first raised almost 10 years ago. So I guess that's the problem with engaging on these national policy debates, is that the bill, as impractical as it might seem, pushes towards a reformation that the private sector and public sector actually need.
But it's forcing the private sector to rethink, and the private sector is saying, well, hold on a second, surely we can come up with quicker, more sustainable solutions to better access to healthcare as a private sector than allowing NHI to go through in its current form, which destroys and damages not only public healthcare, but seriously undermines a very strong, globally competitive private healthcare system. And it's forcing, I think, some fairly creative thinking.
Yeah, and some of that thinking has also been around for a while. So effectively, there are between 2.5 to another 4 million people who actually pay for private sector services out of their pockets. And that's not the best way of funding. And so incorporating them into a healthcare insurance cover under a private sector, like a medical scheme, actually brings the overall cost not only down for medical schemes, but then relieves the burden on those public facilities to provide services to them.
The problem is the public facilities are badly managed. They may be perfectly well funded. Healthcare consumes a huge part of the national budget each and every single year. Comes down to a management problem, as it does in so many parts of our public service. If we address that, surely we begin to tackle some of the more fundamental issues.
Oh, absolutely, Bruce. The leadership within the public sector health system is what needs a relook. Some of the agendas and the motivations are misaligned. So almost all of the public sector facilities don't have any view of what revenue could be incorporated in those facilities. In fact, medical scheme members have access to public facilities as well. And there are a few centers of excellence in the country. So there are a few dominantly in the Western Cape, but there are a few that even medical scheme members would go and utilize because they're managed properly, efficiently, and have some of the best outcomes in the country. And so what you want to do is generate more and more of those facilities that could be accessed by both public and private, and attract some of the private funding into those facilities as well.
Thank you to Craig Comrie. Craig is the chair of the Health Funders Association, looking for alternatives while this document sits on the president's desk. And under the current president, it doesn't look like it's going to be signed. Should that change after the 29th of May? And goodness knows whether it does or does not. How does that change the attitude of the next person who may occupy that seat? Should that person be different, of course? It could have a fundamentally different outcome. This is why pressure is building. It's Eyewitness News Time.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. The Money Show is brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSB. Nick Haralambos is standing by. Nick Haralambos is a business coach who has been a regular contributor on The Money Show for many years. Pick up with him on the signals that he wished he'd sent himself from the future, I suppose, or what he wished he'd known in terms of his younger self. He's turning 40, is our Nick. It's hard to believe, really. Doesn't look good. Day over 25. He's a very youthful-looking fella and a very grounded outlook in the world. Pick up with him in just a moment. We'll also then catch up on the issue of the Africa Business Report. Diana Games is standing by. MTN very much in the frame once again. Two South African companies are lightening their exposure to Nigeria. MTN looks like it's staying committed. And then Warren Ingram this evening. Is there ever a reason to play the lottery? Are you a lottery player? Are you somebody who's won money in the lottery? Is there ever, from a personal financial situation, ever a reason to play the lottery? That's a good and provocative one from Warren this evening. Looking forward to that tonight here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
A different kind of signals feature for you this evening, although it is about how often you read the signals in your own life, how often you pause to reflect on where you've come from, where you are, and where you're going to. Nick Haralambos is a business coach. He's just turned 40 and has written a letter to his 20-year-old self, and it's absolutely lovely. Nick Haralambos, welcome to The Money Show once again this evening. Do you do this regularly? Talk to yourself in as you get older? Do you talk to your younger self on a regular basis?
It's funny you should mention that, Bruce. I feel like I'm going a bit crazy. It started when I was turning 30, and I, on a whim, wrote a post very quickly and punched it out, and it took a life on its own. It's been read over a million times online. There are products that feature lines from it. It's ridiculous. And that's been a decade. So I decided to write a similar idea from my 40-year-old self to my 20-year-old self and published it this week because I turned 40 this week. And that's kind of how regularly I talk to my past self.
How different is the letter to from your 30-year-old self to your 20-year-old self from the 40-year-old to the 20-year-old?
I think that the decade in my 30s has softened me a little bit, so I'm a little bit more giving, a little bit more caring with myself. You know, in your 20s, you feel like you're impenetrable and everything must be brute-forced and success is one form and one factor, and coming towards 40, you realize that there is more to it than acquiring things and ambitiously ravaging the world. So I'd say that my 40-year-old self is telling my 20-year-old self to be a little bit more careful with himself and kind to himself and, you know, not be so hard on himself.
This idea of going to therapy is becoming more widely accepted as something that is not done because you're nuts, because you need help. It's kind of a, is it a self-development thing? What is it about therapy that is becoming a sort of a more universally acceptable way for people to sort of figure out who they are and where they, why they matter in the world?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's summed up in one phrase. I think I first heard this phrase from a friend of mine, Howard Mann. He said, you can't read the label from inside the bottle. And I think for me, that's what therapy is. South African men are historically very anti-self-development and mental health conversations. And I've gone out of my way to make a point of telling people that therapy changed my life. Having access to somebody point out things that can help you live more comfortably and understand your brain in a better way. You just can't know your brain the way that a professional can understand the patterns and see things you can't see. Like when you're in the mess, it's hard to unpack the mess.
You make about 100 points, and I'm going to have to cherry pick some of them. I'm going to cherry pick some of my personal favorites on here. Eat the food that makes you happy and eat it without guilt. Exercise only as often as you can. Bring yourself to exercise. Now, you're speaking my kind of language, although, you know, it's potentially quite self-destructive, is it not, Nick?
I think the perspective of this post, it's very important to remember that it's to me. And it's about what I am capable of. And I've spent most of my life wishing I was exercising more, wishing I had a flatter stomach, wishing I didn't eat as much chocolate as I ate. But the truth is, I love eating chocolate. And the guilt is the worst part of eating it. So I've got to get over the guilt. And I like exercising because it helps me eat more chocolate. And that's okay, too. It isn't. It's hard because in the world, women have been smashed by advertising for so many decades that I feel like men are only just starting to feel that pain, where if you don't have the men's health body, then you don't feel good about yourself. So I'm trying to reframe that for myself.
There are a couple of things that are interesting, and they're kind of interconnected a little bit. One of those is that it's okay to say no, and you don't have to tell people why you've said no. Mm. And as soon as you sent that to me, then I saw Stephen Bartlett was doing a whole podcast on, you know, the importance of saying no. And then a whole bunch of other people said the importance of saying no. And it's you know, and connected to that, I suppose, quite loosely, saying it's okay to not have an opinion about something. And I think in a social media world, you're available 24 hours. Everybody might want to know your opinion. People push you for an opinion, often on contentious issues that you don't fully understand, on issues that you feel that you're not qualified to have an opinion on, yet it doesn't stop half the idiots in the world from doing so. And that is kind of an important realization, I think, as we become older, it's okay just to shut up.
Yeah, there's two things wrapped up in there. The first, it's okay to say no without giving a reason. This is a very hard lesson to learn, but I think as you get older, you stop caring about how other people perceive your responses. And I spent many years saying no because, you know, I can't do this because I've got this on, or I can't do that in case this happens. And actually, I realized that when I just started saying no, thank you, that was enough. It's enough to say no, thank you. You don't need to justify to the other person who's imposed their request upon you why you can't do the thing they've demanded of you. You can just say no. And if they want to ask a follow-up question, it's on them to ask the follow-up question. It's not on you. This applies in business and in your personal life. In business, if somebody wants you to do something that you don't want to do, you can just say, no, thank you. Very nice opportunity. It's not for me. And move on. And then tying that to not having an opinion about something, this one I struggled with and is something therapy helped me with. Just because you feel like you have an opinion about something doesn't mean you should speak your opinion. Like, the thing that I'm trying to get my head around at the moment is something I read that we have social media, the internet, it's a gift to humanity, the internet specifically, but it has shortened the work required to learn something at depth. So we think that we read a tweet, watch a 5-minute YouTube video, and then have an opinion about something. Let me tell you, that is not true. Your 12-minute YouTube clip about the wars going on around, that does not entitle you to a deep-seated opinion about something that has been going on for 100 years. That just means you skated over some cliff notes and have some view because you want hits on social media. It's okay to not post about that. It's okay to let the experts speak.
I just love it. Absolutely love it. I don't think anybody goes as far as the YouTube video anymore, quite frankly. But that's just my opinion. And it's based on absolutely nothing other than a thumb suck. When it comes to running a business, and I mean, you've run many businesses, you've founded businesses, you've shut them down, you've sold a couple. This, and it's a notion that has come through very strongly. You seem to be softening it a little bit. This idea of choosing better ideas. And this is... Oh, so good. In terms of the way in which we think of ourselves as entrepreneurs, the way we position ourselves as entrepreneurs, and whether our ideas land or don't, you think to yourself, well, what's wrong with these people? Don't they know that this is the best idea ever? Perhaps it isn't.
Yeah, I used to spend a lot of time talking about how many businesses I've started and failed and how many I've succeeded at, and I have realized now that I'm turning 40 that that is the wrong index to be measuring. So the choose better ideas comes from the principle that I wish that I had researched for longer and executed quicker. Instead, I executed quicker and discovered thereafter. So I think that if you're listening and you've got an idea, take some time to figure out if it's the best idea for you, the best idea for your lifestyle, the best idea to help you earn the kind of money you want to earn from the idea, instead of going, oh, nobody else is doing that, I'm just going to build this. Well, take a second, breathe a little. One of my other points is just take 5 minutes. Take 5 minutes, do the research, think about it, and then come back to it. I just built stuff because I was good at executing. And I wish that I'd paused a little bit longer, worked out if the ideas were viable financially for me and my lifestyle, and then proceeded.
It comes to the idea of failure, but we tend to celebrate success. We don't necessarily, I don't want to say celebrate failure, but acknowledge failure as a learning path. And perhaps a little less failure is better than quite a lot of failure. But what's your thinking around failure as you hit the big 4-0?
Anybody who's listened to you and I talk over the last decade, Bruce, will know that I am a fan of failure. I firmly believe that failure is the most likely outcome to almost anything you're going to do ever. And if you are trying to learn how to play tiddlywinks or trying to build a billion-dollar business, the first 20, 30 tries are going to be failures. It's pushing through that matters, right? Not the failure. It's the learning that matters, not the failure. So I believe that you have to care enough about something to fail at it and fail at it repeatedly so that you can then learn the lesson and succeed. That does very carefully and cautiously tie into another point I have, which is, it's also okay to quit sometimes. You don't have to fail until it kills you.
Yeah, very important. Very, very important on there. Now, on money, what do you wish 20-year-old Nick had known that 40-year-old Nick is recovering from when it comes to money?
Honestly, I think we over-index on the amount of advice people give to young people about money. I wish that I had not spent on rubbish. That's it. I'm not telling you to not spend. I wish the 20-year-old Nick had spent his money on traveling, on experiencing, on living, not on a house that he lost money on, a car that he didn't care about, and going out and drinking booze that made him feel sick. That was silly spending. So that's the one part. The other part is, and this is advice that my mom gave me that I just flat out ignored because I kept thinking, I'm going to be rich one day, is I wish that I just religiously saved 10% of my salary and acted like I didn't have that money. Because today, 20 years later, being 20 feels like it was yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. And then you wrap it up with the probably the most sage advice of all as to how you should plan, how you should think, how you should work, and how you should live. And I think I've seen this versions of this elsewhere, but take me through your thinking around it.
I'm going to openly claim that 10 years ago, I wrote this line down in my first article and ended that article with it. And since, it has been taken and put on T-shirts and posters and pillows and sold around the world. I've contacted those businesses. I am owning this line. I wrote this line, plan in decades, think in years, work in months, and live in days. And genuinely, when I hit 30, I understood that decades come at you quicker than you think and years work slower than you think. So in the year, you have more time to do things because it's slower than you think it is. The decade, it moves so quickly. I cannot fathom that I'm 40. So the plans you have to make need to look at the decade. Where do you want to be when you're 40? And that is about your health, your business, your money. Like, do you want to be a fat person who can't exercise? Do you want to be a thin person who's decrepit and can't move because they gain all the time? Make those choices and live that life. That's okay. Just plan for that, as long as you're thinking about it.
Plan in decades, think in years, work in months, live in days. What's that about? Spontaneity, seizing the opportunity, making sure that you don't be so busy focusing on the decades that you actually forget to have fun day by day?
Yeah, I lean towards being a bit of a nihilist in my approach to the world. So I don't necessarily believe in a legacy. One of my mechanisms is to build a life, not a legacy. And I believe in living in the days and appreciating the moment that you've got and the small, minute things that don't seem relevant, because the days add up. The days add up to the months, and the months add up to the years, and the years add up to the decades.
Nick Haralambos, I'm so glad we had the chat, and thank you for agreeing to do it. Business coach Nick Haralambos this evening on The Money Show. You'll find the entire post online. It is deeply reflective. It's incredibly personal. It's a letter from himself to himself. These are not life lessons for everybody, but from it, I'm sure you will extract an awful lot of wisdom. Our Africa Business Focus, brought to you by SAA, connecting Africa one flight at a time, now flying to Perth, Australia.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
And I saw the aircraft arriving in Perth, and it was welcomed, and there were people cheering, and Perth looked like Bloemfontein. I've not been there, but it did look like Bloemfontein in the middle of winter. Just saying. Diana Games is the chief executive of Africa at Work. It's a business consultancy. We were talking about MTN Nigeria's trading update today and looking at just how tough that environment is for MTN. But it's not just for MTN. Lots of South African companies for many, many years have gone in with big, audacious aims, goals and ideas, and many of them have beaten a hasty retreat. The latest two selling businesses in Nigeria, Old Mutual and, again, Sun International.
Yes, hello, Bruce. A long way from Perth, back to Nigeria. it seems like this is that they're both rushing for the exit, but that's not quite what's happened here. So let me just start with Sun International. They invested in Nigeria in 2006. And as you point out, there was this kind of idea that, you know, this has opened up, let's get there, big market, all of this. Sun International is one of those. They went and bought 49% of the Tourist Company of Nigeria, locally owned company in 2006. So that's some time back. And they were the largest shareholder in that company. Then they ended up in this very ugly spat between two families, two brothers and their families, who were at loggerheads about the shareholding, about the deal with Sun International, etc. And this in turn led to a long official investigation, which only ended around 2018, 2019. But they have long, I've been talking to them for years in Nigeria. They've wanted to exit for many years, more than a decade, but they were unable to do so because of this investigation. So now that's complete. They have finally sold their stake to a local company, Rutam Finance Company. I've never heard of them, but they're another associate of another shareholder in the same Tourist Company of Nigeria. They own, people who've traveled to Lagos will know, the Federal Palace Hotel on Victoria Island, Hotel and Casino, and Sun International is part of that deal. So that is a long-standing kind of issue that's been going on. Old Mutual, on the other hand, also entered, I think, around the same time, but certainly a while ago, excuse me, and they... that is a new kind of move. They are selling their life and general insurance business in Nigeria, also to Nigerian investors, because I think that, you know, things have been tough. The insurance industry in Nigeria is not an easy one. It's not, insurance is not a kind of a you know, like generally accepted like it is here, for example. Oh, okay. And they've had to really push that over the years. And it's getting there, but I think maybe not fast enough. I'm not sure. I haven't spoken to Old Mutual people about this. They only announced it actually, I think, in the last sort of week or so. But they are continuing their presence in Nigeria through another part of the group, which is the Africa Infrastructure Investment Managers. So they're not leaving Nigeria completely, but they are certainly leaving the insurance business. But as you say, you know, it does look like the optics are not good. And whatever the reasons, they're various, you know, there are problems one way or the other, however long-standing those problems might be. And in some cases, if you look at Nampak, for example, they have huge debt in their Africa operation or their general operation, and they're selling Nigeria to actually refinance that debt. So there are different reasons that people are doing things. But yeah, the optics are negative. And as you say, and when MTN's not doing well, when they're battling, and I saw the update today and their recent results, it's not a good place to be. And of course, it's not just the South Africans. I think a lot of companies are battling in Nigeria at the moment. But we hope, you know, the tide will turn at some point. It seems to be slowly but surely getting there. But I don't know. We'll see what that actually means.
Yep, you've got to have a huge amount of foresight in order to do the stuff successfully. Iran is doing some interesting visiting around the African continent, looking for friends, perhaps.
Yes, definitely. definitely looking for friends. This week, I think it started at the weekend, the Iran Africa Economic Conference, or some version of that, which is basically another continent to country event. We've seen a lot of these, you know, Italy, Africa, China, Africa, various of these. And of course, all the African governments rushed to whatever country it is. And apparently, according to Iran, anyway, there were 40 African countries represented. I don't know of that how many were heads of state. But Iran joined BRICS in January, so in a way that does make sense. They are looking for friends, as you say, under sanctions from the US and I think other countries. And So they want to sort of turn their sights on countries that are going to be their friends. And I think Africa is very much on the radar for a lot of these kind of countries. We've seen others in like Russia, you know, for example, everybody's looking at it. And as you're seeing withdrawals of Western countries from like the Sahel, for example, you're seeing these countries moving very quickly into that gap. So in fact, there is no gap. I mean, people are, you know, the new countries are moving in. It is the second time they've had this economic conference. And I think a lot of it is premised on more on soft power than anything. I think they're probably kind of serious trade with Iran. I know South Africa, I think up until about a decade ago, South Africa bought a lot of oil from Iran. But I think that stopped as a result of the U.S. sanctions. But I'm sure we're still doing other trade there. But so I think, you know, it's a case of they want new partnerships. Africa is quite welcoming. They want to move away from hostile Western nations, as do many African countries. And Africa's, an obvious place to go. But I think if I look at in Zimbabwe today, was talking about it on one of the government officials on social media, saying that they'd done deals on scholarships and training and things like that. So at the moment, and I think visas maybe, at the moment, it certainly looks like very much a soft power play rather than, but you know, weapons is a big issue as well. Mm. I think they are already selling weapons to Sudan and places like that. So we'll see, you know, there's a lot of these kind of countries lining up. Our trade sort of profile is really starting to change over time. So it'd be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, no judgment. Are you worried that African countries are struggling to get to grips with the sustainable development goals? I mean, these sustainable development goals are quite big, they're quite lofty, and they are fundamental in driving outcomes in terms of improving the way countries operate, the way countries look after their people, ultimately. And African countries seem to be lagging.
In a conference in the Economic Commission for Africa in Addis Ababa last week, and they discussed that the focus of this was how far Africa has gone in towards achieving the sustainable development goals. And they only examined five out of the 17 goals in total, but they were looking only at five, and we didn't come off very well even within those five. And I think the biggest movement was in achieving zero hunger. But we're a long way, you know, if you think the target for this kind of current set is of goals, reaching these goals is 2030, we're not any more that far off there. And if you look at the charts, we're a long way off that goal. And even though we're moving forward slowly, and same with no poverty, in terms of action, climate action, we've actually regressed. So there's not much happening there at all. And there's a lot of push, you know, that's very much the topic on everyone's lips at the moment. I mean, hunger and poverty have been around a long time. But yeah, it's just worrying to think that, I mean, I just don't know whether we'll ever get on top of this. And when you go to these big kind of African, pan-African bureaucracy type conferences, there's so much talk, there's a lot of information, but it's very hard to see how this rubber hits the road with this kind of thing. I mean, there's just almost too many organizations, as you said, lofty kind of goals and so on. And I have this view that having followed NEPAD at the time when it was, you know, very sort of top of the pops, it's very like in NEPAD. I mean, people were asking the question, you know, what do people even know? No, sort of Africa ran, sort of people in general in Africa know what the SDGs are, how it can change their lives. Do they even know what it's about and what it has to do with their lives? And I think the answer generally was no, you know. So it doesn't mean people shouldn't keep trying. And I think that obviously that's the goal in itself. But yeah, it feels like will we ever get on top of this? We've done so little in a long time that it is quite depressing to think about it, to be honest.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
I often get asked why it is that when you see somebody buying a lottery ticket, it's usually somebody who isn't particularly affluent. I recall a quip from Wayne McCurry. He's with F&B Wealth and Investments, of course, when the lottery first launched in South Africa more than 20 years ago. He said, "Lotteries are for people who don't understand basic mathematics." And I still find that a prescient observation. But I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I really do. I think it's a bit more complicated than simply talking about mathematics. It's, I don't know, Warren Ingram, co-founder at Galileo Capital, certified financial planner, whether there's ever a reason for anybody to buy a lottery ticket, considering just how low the odds are of you getting the right numbers in the right order on the right day to get the right jackpot to change your life?
It's such a difficult question when you're playing with probability. So the very short answer is, if you're only dealing in pure math, then your answer is probably there is no mathematical reason for you to play the lottery. You know, just understanding that your chances of actually winning the big one are as close to zero as you can get without it being zero. And so I think I've heard another asset manager, I don't want to misquote him, but so I won't say his name, but I think he said it's a tax on people that don't understand math. And you know, all of that makes sense to me when I use my rational brain. But I think the one thing to understand about human beings is, when we have no hope, when we believe we really have no chance to improve the circumstances, you know, of ourselves and our family, we will try and find a way out of an entirely hopeless situation. And I think if you look at a huge proportion of the people in our country, but certainly, you know, around the world, there are a large group of people who feel, you know, they would have been unemployed for, you know, their entire adult lives. They live on a social grant, and have almost no prospect of, as far as they're concerned, of raising their standard of living beyond what it is today and what that they can foresee for the rest of their lives. And if you say to someone in that position that I offer you a one in many millions chance of fundamentally changing your life and the lives of your family, I think most people in a situation like that would at least be tempted to take the chance. And so, you know, I have to say, Bruce, you know, as a financial planner, and I couldn't, you know, kind of sit here in good conscience and say, no, it's a great idea, we should all play the lotto every week. You know, I think it's not true. You know, I think the you know, okay, people who have the ability
but that's the point here, Warren, is that you've got people who, you know, with the two, or I don't know, what does the lottery ticket cost? R2.50 or R3, and they play one line once a week, and just in case the gods of good fortune or the fairy of happiness shines down upon them, that, you know, they may win R100,000 or R10 million, and really mess up their lives. But that opportunity is a life-changing dream, and I think in many cases it keeps people sort of hoping. But if you've got a job and you've got a decent salary and you've got decent capacity and you're going in there buying 10 lines a week, or twice a week, or however often these games are played, I'm wondering if you're not doing yourself some serious economic harm on the very low probability that even with 10 lines twice a week over 30 years, you'll ever win anything substantial.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's exactly the people that earn a salary that are able to save that shouldn't be playing the lottery. Excuse me, one second.
Now explain that, because it's such an
frog out of my throat.
No, you do that. You switch off your microphone. I will make inane small talk with myself until you stop being French. And as you do that, you come back in full-throated voice. I noticed my voice cracked earlier. Diana Games' voice cracked a little bit, and now yours is cracking. I think there's something going on here. Maybe the conversation will go viral. Something in the air. Most certainly, it is that time of year. Now, talk to me then about good middle-class earners. Why is it that they should not pay the lottery on the same opportunity set that a poorer person should pay the lottery?
Because the money that you're accumulating already, you know, you have a very high chance that if you keep saving and you allocate those savings to an investment every month of every year for a career, you know, 30-year career, there is a very good chance. You know, it's more than a 50-50 chance. You know, whether it's a 70% chance or an 80% chance, you know, that doesn't really matter. But there is a really good chance that your money will continue to grow and generate growth on itself. It will be compounding. Your money will be making money babies. All you need to do is be reasonably sensible that you allocate the money to something that's, you know, very well diversified, and you know, whether it's an index or a balanced unit trust doesn't really matter, but allocate the money to that, save every single month and keep adding to those savings as you go, and give it time to grow. You have a very good chance that you will substantially improve your financial position by doing nothing else. And so if you're playing the odds, the probabilities are very high that every 50 Rand that you allocate to that kind of a saving will make a fundamental difference to your life, because you're not only allocating 50 Rand. And I think that's the point, is when you're able to allocate 50 Rand when you're 20 and 2000 Rand when you're 30 and, you know, 10,000 Rand when you're 40, and so on. All the money that you can add to your investments will continue to compound and grow at an accelerating rate. And there is almost no gambling or risk involved if you give it time and if you're sensible. And so the odds are entirely in your favor. You control a lot of the outcomes by just being patient and adding money every single time you can. And so for people in that position, There actually is no mathematical reason to play the lotto at all. You could probably argue, Bruce, and now I'm kind of getting creative, which is always dangerous in the evening, but you could probably argue that someone that's in a very good financial position, that has enough money, they could afford to take some of that money and play the lotto. And Murphy being Murphy, they'll probably win, which will upset the rest of us. but the people at either end of the spectrum, the people that have very little and the people that have far too much can actually take the risk, because for people with very little, the probability, even though it's entirely small and very, very, you know, I mean, almost zero, but not, the probability that they can fundamentally change their lives, it's worth it, because the 50 Rand a month that they would be adding to some kind of a saving, if they could afford to do it, won't change their financial position substantially, even if they save for 30 years.
Okay. I'm trying to hedge this just a little bit. Let's say, for example, I earn a decent middle class salary. I live a lovely middle class life and I do my saving in the way that you suggest, but I keep 3 Rand every week and I buy one line of the lottery on a Saturday night for just in case. I keep the same, is it six numbers? Say six numbers. And I do this week in and week out, and I do it for 30 years. Okay, so I take 3 Rand a week times 52, that's not very much money, it's 156 Rand a year, times 30 years, that's less than 5,000 Rand over 30 years, 4,680 to be precise, that I would be spending on the remote possibility that one day my ship comes in, and maybe on one of those days I win a 10,000 prize or a 15,000 Rand prize because I got however many numbers correct, 4 out of the 6 or whatever. I didn't win the big jackpot, but kind of the game paid for itself over time. Now, assuming I'm disciplined enough to do just one line over that period of time with exactly the same numbers, mathematically, I don't know if that helps at all. Whether I win or lose, it's only 4,680 Rand. Could that 4,680 Rand, that even that 3 Rand a week, have made a substantial impact over that period of time to my financial outcome? Could it really, or is it worth the punt?
I think it's the kind of last point that I'd like to add to your scenario is really what you're doing with a very high degree of probability is you're actually just throwing that money away. That's really what you're doing. The chance of breaking out and getting, you know, substantial winnings is so small that you have to say, I'm doing this actually for the entertainment value, for the thrill of possibly, winning something substantial. And other than that, it's as valuable to my financial position as, you know, streaming a movie, you know, where you pay for it and then you get no other benefit. Yeah. It's the same outcome. It's the same, you know, I guess the economists would call it utility. But yes, the answer is it probably wouldn't change your financial position. So you go in saying, you know, my 2 rand 50 or 3 rand, whatever it is, I'm actually throwing it away on a thrill. That's what I'm doing once a week. And if that's your context, then, you know, good luck and well done. But that's all it is. You know, we really have to be, you know, clear that, you know, the people who have nothing, you know, have almost nothing to lose. And therefore taking a very small chance on a life-changing outcome makes sense. But when you have assets and you are accumulating, then every cent is valuable and you should actually let it grow as fast as you can. And throwing it away, you know, it's your choice, but be clear that, you know, this financial plan is not telling you to do that. This financial plan is telling you to keep saving and thank us in 30 years' time.
You're so hard. I can't believe that this person is a friend of mine. A friend of mine shared a flat in London many, many years ago in the early days of the lottery in the UK and had a video machine. And what he did was record the last week's lottery. And at the time of this week's lottery, bought a ticket with last week's numbers. When his flatmate came back to the house, he said to him, "Oh, listen, I'm just going to have a quick shower. Won't you just check the lottery numbers for me, please?" And handed the lottery ticket to the guy, set the video machine off, went to the bathroom, put the shower on, and stood at the door and watched. This poor man went, as the numbers started coming in, number 1, 16, number 8. And by the time he got to 4 numbers correct, his friend was sitting on the edge of the sofa, shouting at the television. Got to 5 numbers. He was like completely beside himself with excitement. Got to the 6th number and looked, stared at the piece of paper, stared at the screen, stared at the piece of paper, ran to the bathroom and said to him, "We've won, we've won, we've won." To which the man, who happens still to be my friend, took the ticket away from him and said, "No, we haven't. I've won. Thanks very much for that." And it's one of the best pranks, I think, in history. So from that point of view, I think the lottery offers an enormous amount of value just to abuse your friends. Really. It's a good trick. Try it sometime. Warren Ingram is a certified financial planner. He is a director at Galileo Capital. And in a moment, we are going to be talking about Mike's question. Mike says that we've been speaking about offshore investments on the show for many years. I've gained some great points from it. Thank you. I was thinking about taking it a step further to keep the money offshore even after my death. Interesting. How do offshore trusts work, and when is it a good idea to have one? When you've got enough money to pay for one, I suppose, Mike. But that question to Warren Ingram, it's a higher grade question, but it's an important question for many South Africans who are looking to preserve long-term wealth. Thank you for the question, Mike. Answer from Warren Ingram coming up in just a bit.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
So, Warren, Mike is captivated by offshore investing, has invested money offshore, but wants to keep the money offshore even after his death. The way to do that, I assume, would be via, as he suggests, an offshore trust. So when might it be a good idea to get one?
I think it's an important point just to understand that if you die in South Africa and you've got investments overseas, on your death, no one's obliged to bring that money back unless you've stipulated that in your will or there are taxes or costs to be paid. So for Mike, you know, if Mike has South African assets and offshore assets and he dies, he can stipulate in his will that his offshore assets go to his, you know, beneficiaries, whoever they may be, and the local assets are then used to pay or his estate duties and you know, any other taxes that are due and any other expenses that are incurred. So I think the first thing is, you know, you don't need to set up an offshore trust, you know, only for that purpose. You can do it in another way. But if it's a substantial amount of money and you would like to be sure that the people who are inheriting might only inherit it later in life, you know, let's say, for example, you've got 12-year-old kids, you know, you don't necessarily want them inheriting a whole whack of money at the age of 12, then you might consider an offshore trust. And equally, if you would like your grandchildren to inherit and they're potentially not even born yet, then again, that becomes a sensible reason to consider a trust. The trick, though, and that's what you were highlighting, Bruce, is that you know these are not free offshore trusts, and in fact they're at the opposite end of the cost spectrum. They're very expensive. I needed to be careful with my adjective there. So I think you're in for somewhere around $3,000 to $5,000 just to set up a very simple trust, and then you're probably in for the same amount on an annual basis to run the trust. And if there is anything complicated in that trust where you've got a business or a rental property or anything that's just not absolutely generic, your costs can balloon very quickly. And then all the benefit that you think you're getting from saving estate duty or potential capital gains or just ensuring a smooth transition of assets from one generation to the next, all of those benefits might be eroded by the monster of fees. And eventually, you know, you start with your $100,000 and 20 years later, your $100,000 is zero and they close the trust and the trustees have earned some great money and your beneficiary's got nothing. So you have to be very sensible around the amount of money that's going to go into the trust. And, you know, from my kind of very, simple calculations, I tend to think it becomes viable when you're sitting on about $1 million worth of investments and preferably even more before the trust might start to wash its face with the growth of your investment money. And it doesn't, give you a high chance of eroding that capital over time. So I think if I'm in Mike's position, I'm looking at, either putting in very high growth assets. If you're certain that you've got the next Facebook or the next Apple, and you're just starting out, then maybe you put those shares into that and hope that, they double and double and double for the next 5 or 10 years. Then you'll be very happy to have had your money in an offshore trust. Or if you've got a substantial amount already, then consider it. But if you're just worried about, in comparative to $1 million, a small amount of money, in $100,000 or $50,000, and you want that to go to the next generation, then speak to someone who does wills and make sure that your will is correct and that your planning around the balance of your assets is correct. And then you can leave that money offshore your estate can leave that money offshore on your death. You can kind of move it from one generation to the next or one beneficiary to the other relatively simply. You don't need to then set up a trust for someone in that position.
Okay. Absolutely critical, Warren. And I think so many people get, caught up in, the jargon and the hype and think, I must do the right thing and I must protect the assets. The assets must be held in some sort of vehicle so that it gets used for the purpose that I want it to be used for. But I suppose you could do that by a letter of will saying I'd like my grandchildren to get, an American education or a British education if they want one. So there is money in a bank account or there's money in an investment account. Please utilize that. You don't have to go to a trust where you start dictating precisely what happens. You trust future generations to make the best use of whatever money is there, to keep it as sustainable as possible, to do what you hoped it would do. You work very hard and you have a goal, but you don't want to be losing that money. Again, I'm choosing adjectives carefully, through silly, unnecessary fees. Thank you, Warren Ingram, who is an executive director. And sorry, one more point, Warren. What was that? Or were you just saying goodbye?
Just be very careful of the tax advisor who tells someone who's, relatively elderly that, you should put all your money in a trust because you're saving estate duty. Again, you could be doing it, terrible disservice to your beneficiaries because of the massive fees that you're going to be paying.
Wonderful. Thank you, Warren Ingram at Galileo Capital.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield was brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions to unlock the full potential of your business story. APSA is a registered FSP.